Come on.
You actually inspect every elevator once a year?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, correct. Under current statute, I'm required to inspect every elevator once a year.
If you don't mind me saying, I think that's ridiculous.
Mr.
Chair. That's why he's here.
Mr. Chair, I think that's why I'm here. And we're wanting to take this out of statute and have us analyze this through the administrative rule. So that's what we want to do.
I'm curious. What is an elevator that moves 10 inches? Well, give me an example.
Sure. Mr. Chair, a wheelchair lift. You may see some of those that just need to go up a particular rise to get over a curb or something like that. They don't move very far. There are many different types of elevators, from dumbwaiters to the elevators we see here in the Capitol, to high-rise buildings, to actually escalators and moving walks are inspected as well every year. And lifts, small lifts that just move, like I say, if they move vertically, we inspect them.
Wow. Any other questions?
Does the DCBS actually have people on staff that inspect the elevators, or do you hire it out to elevator specialists? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, the elevator program actually is the only program in my department where we are the sole provider of inspections on a statewide basis. We have state inspectors, I don't remember the exact number, that cover the state. They have areas, they have routes, and they inspect each of the elevators every year.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. How many of these do we have that you will not, percentage-wise, you're doing 100% now. By doing this, what's that going to cut down on your workload percentage-wise?
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know off the top. I can tell you there's about 8,000 elevators in the state of Oregon that we regulate, and that's a rough number. How many of them are the smaller type versus the larger type, I really don't know, but let's say that it's 10%, just for the purposes of today. Historically, elevator growth in Oregon since the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act in the early 90s, our workload has increased about 6% every biennium. Every 2 years over the last three or four biennium. And so typically what we've done is we've come back to, not necessarily this committee, but the legislature, looking for staff and fees to deal with these adjustments. This is one of our measures of looking at productivity and trying to figure out how to get the job done under current resources and current staffing. So actual reduction, I don't know, but this is our first shot at it. And we think by working with the board and the industry, we can really target what we inspect and when. So that's really why I'm here.
I think we would like to have a work group on this. I believe the chair had indicated. And Representative Holby, did you want to participate in that?
Why, yes, I would.
The chair disagreed if you wanted to. Is that true? That's a vicious rumor.
Well, that rumor is confirmed. Yes, I will.
So he started the rumor. So.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate that.
Really.
Would you work with Representative Holby on this and get a work group?
I would love to. This is very important to us, and I appreciate the attention.
Okay, we'll hold this over. Close the public. Oh, no, we have someone else. Catherine Bonetta?
Good morning. Catherine Bonetta, representing the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. I'm handing out written testimony on House Bill 2180 and 2181, asking that the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association be included in the work groups on these bills. And if you're wondering why we're interested in elevators, it's because our industrial manufacturing facilities, the pulp and paper mills, do have specialized elevators. And we're interested in it because of that angle. And we're also interested in House Bill 2181 and the synergy, perhaps, of other bills that have been introduced this session about our work practices in our facilities. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you. Anyone else would like to address 2180? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing. Move this to a work group, including Pulp and Paper and Representative Holby. And you're going to head it up, Mark Long, correct? Okay, with that, I'll open up the public hearing on 2181. Patrick Allen, Mark Long.
I'm Patrick Allen, manager of the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. Again, this is one of the 37 odd bills in the regulatory streamlining legislative package. This bill is, frankly, huge, and there's plenty of grist for questions and issues. You're going to hear from Mark that this is another bill that we think needs some further work before it's really ready for you to consider. But the basic gist of the bill is to provide authority to simplify not licensing requirements, but licensing systems and processes to make the function of licensing more straightforward and easier to navigate. And with that, I turn it over to Mark again to talk in detail about the bill.
Thanks, Pat. Good morning again, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long with State Building Codes Division. You should have a copy of my written comments for House Bill 2181. Let me provide you just a little bit of background about building codes and licensing. We issue approximately 85 different license types at building codes through 7 different program areas. It represents roughly about 42,000 individuals that we serve in the state of Oregon. During this interim, we initiated a customer service survey to folks to our licensees, and one of the many things that we received feedback on is, you know, how can you help speed up the process of licensing, and how can you make it more consistent? To give you an example, in these 7 different program areas, and when I talk about program areas, I'm talking about electrical licenses, plumbing license, manufactured housing, etc. The terms, so what we call the licenses and the processes, are different between these 85 different types. What this bill attempts to do is make it streamline the process, make it the terms the same, definitions the same, and for how you apply for a license, how you renew your license, how you expire or pay for your license, the process would be the same. And I can kind of give you an example, just very quickly. Let's say I'm a plumbing contractor and also an electrical contractor. Before last session, and with the help of this bill, those contractors would have to carry 2 different cards in their wallet. One would renew, I think, in April. One would renew in October. They didn't get to pick the renewal dates. This bill will give us the authority to set those renewal dates, give the person basically an account, and then he or she can manage their licenses with us and go into our system, figure out the expiration periods, figure out the renewal dates, make the system a lot cleaner and a lot smoother. And that's really what we're trying to accomplish here. The bill is quite large. It's a multitude of pages. It's a simple thing that we're trying to do, although because it touches so many statutes, it's complex and large, and the bill needs amendments, and we do need to go to a work group.
Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Catherine Vanetta. She giving them both?
That one's good.
So she just wants to be included in the work group. I have one thing here that maybe you shouldn't jump off here real quick. I have an email from an engineer in Medford. I'm writing about House Bill 2181, Section 61, which is currently being adjusted. I feel very strongly about this section and would strongly recommend that the entire section ORS 497.86 be stricken from law. At the very least, the definition of customer should be clarified to the original intent of the legislation. The original intent was that an electrical contractor working directly for an industrial customer could plan, design, and lay out electrical work without engineering supervision. The result of the legislation that is customer is taken to be anyone, and a great deal of engineering, including critical health care systems, is being engineered in the state of Oregon without the benefit of engineering supervision. This exemption does not apply to any other trade, structural, architectural, mechanical, plumbing, or fire protection, etc., is governed by the Articles and Engineers Board. This exception does not exist in California or Washington. I strongly recommend that the use of customer be defined to be an industrial owner, or the section be deleted completely. So there is a concern on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, something that I probably should have said and need to make very clear. You know, obviously, from my perspective, I'm the administrator of licenses, and wanting to make the process as smooth is my desire. When you get into scoping and criteria and who needs a license and who doesn't need a license, and it sounds like this individual's concerns, that is not what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. I'm simply trying to do administrative provisions. So we realized that as the bill was drafted, it waded into some of those policy areas, and that's why we need to go to committee. I can't tell you that I would come back and change whatever the current law is related to this issue, because it's not under the scope of what we're trying to accomplish. I'm really wanting to get into how they apply, how they renew, you know, the paperwork side. If you'd like me to take a look at this issue, I'd be happy to. But
it's current law.
Yeah, and I'm not proposing to change it.
And of course,
so if it's changed in the bill, we're going to fix that.
When people receive these at home, they don't see the part that we're actually changing. They just see the way it's written. So therefore, they assume that we're doing these changes as we progress. But this, with what my research is, that's current law now, is the way that wording.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I wasn't able to quickly dive into this, but I can tell you we're not intending to change current law on scoping or policy matters, simply administrative paperwork.
Maybe we could discuss that, though.
Yeah, if you could get me the... Maybe I could work with staff to get the email or look into the details.
Okay, I wanted to do that for the record. Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Anyone else would like to testify on this particular bill? Okay, without any further to do, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on 2181. We'll form a work group again. Representative Holby, are you up to the task for two of them?
Well, since the numbers are so close, I think I can do that.
And the subjects are similar. So we'll have the work group again, and then again, pulp and paper people would be involved in that as well. So let's go from there. Get that one finished. Okay, I'm going to go ahead and recess for a 10-minute stay here. Recess. Let's see, you can do it.
You're so efficient, Mr. Chair. We're just knocking them out.
Affairs and open a work session on House Bill 2064. And Janet, get us back to where we were before. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You may recall that House Bill 2064 passed out of this committee on January 26th and was re-referred to committee from the floor due to a question over the definition of resident that's being changed. And if you want to look at the House Bill 2064, page 5, it's lines 3 through 5. And the bill itself is the bill that allows applicants for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, the FEAP program, to include dependent elderly relatives and dependent disabled children living in their home as part of the family when they're applying for the benefit subsidy. Rocky King from the Insurance Pool Governing Board is here to discuss that the purpose of the change in the definition of the term resident.
Thank you, Janet. Rocky, please help us out of our quandary here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator of the Insurance Pool Governing Board, which administers the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. The term resident, as it is currently in statute, is just limited to what that definition is. And it just says resident means this. And it doesn't give the board any authority to add different categories or constrict that definition any more than what it says in statute. And let me give you the best example of why we need to have the board have that authority. When you established the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, commonly referred to as FEOP, in 1997, and we implemented it in 1998, you wanted to make sure that we provided those services to all residents of Oregon, as long as they were here legally. But whether they were citizens or non-citizens, qualified, you were using state funds, and it didn't make any difference. In 2002, during the interim, the emergency board approved what's called the Oregon Health Plan Waiver 2 to get federal dollars to expand the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And by expanding it, by getting those federal dollars, but there were certain requirements with those federal requirements of what those funds could be used for. And they could not be used, for example, for what are called non-qualified residents. Now, those are people that are here legally, but they just don't meet certain qualifications. They haven't been here for a certain period of time, or they weren't in the armed services. It's about a 6-page definition that the federal government has for qualified versus non-qualified residents. There's some question from the Attorney General's office and Legislative Council whether or not we can follow that definition for the use of the federal funds, given the definition we have here now. All this does is allow the board basically to implement the decisions made in 2002 by the legislature to expand our program using federal dollars. It really is, will constrict the number of people we serve, not expand the number of people we serve. And I did meet with Representative Richardson, who had some questions and concerns about this change. And I believe after showing him the Department of Human Resource definitions of residents, the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool definitions of residents, and the FEOP, or the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program definitions, he understood that all of the programs have basically given the authority to the agencies to further define resident in the statute.
Thank you, Rocky. Questions? Don't see any. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay, committee, are we ready to try it again?
You want to give it a whirl?
Yes, I, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we move House Bill 2064, to move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation and try it again.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 2064 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, can you call the roll, please?
Representative Escobar.
Yay.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Representative Holby.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Shockler.
Aye.
Excuse. Aye. Motion carries. Motion to put it back on the consent calendar. Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair, I move we place 2064 on the consent calendar.
Representative Gilman moves House Bill 2064 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any, no objection, it is placed on the consent calendar. Okay. We're down to, which one now? I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2104. Janet, can you give us a rundown?
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2104 was pre-session filed for the Department of Higher Education and modifies provisions of the optional retirement plan that's available to university system employees. The two main things that the bill does, it maintains the linkage to the employer contribution rate to public employee retirement system, so the same employer contribution rates that PERS members receive, but specifies that the rate be set before any adjustment for lump sum payments to PERS by employers. The university system was the effect of the bond measure that was sold as a result of Measure 29 last fall affected the rates that the employees received from the university system pretty significantly. This won't affect that because it's already happened, but it would affect any future lump sum payments such as that bond payment. And the bill also specifies that PERS members that participate in the this alternative plan, the Oregon Retirement Plan, they do so under the same terms adopted for vested and non-vested PERS 1 and 2, Tier 1 and 2 members. Mr. Chair, there is an amendment that we received late yesterday, so it's at your place this morning, and it pretty much makes more specific how the withdrawal is made and gives more specifics as to the process for the withdrawal and how that person is treated when they withdraw from PERS and become a participant in the Oregon, the optional retirement plan. And Mr. Chair, there's
some people here to testify.
There are.
Lisa Zabal, is that right? Zavala, okay, and Denise. I can't read the last one there. Denise, anyway. Good morning.
Denise Younger. Good morning. For the record, I'm Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System, and I'm in the Office of Government Relations. Denise Younger is our benefits administrator, and she's with our Department of Higher Human Resources, and she is the expert on this. I will try to go through this and do it justice, but any specific questions I'll have to probably defer to Denise. As Janet said, the Oregon University System does offer an optional retirement program to our administrative staff and faculty. It is more of a mobile type pension program so that our employees, when they move around the country to teach or work at institutions of higher education, they can take it with them. It's a portable plan. We have had this plan since 1996. It was enacted in 1995. And it does offer a choice of retirement plans and fund, and we have four fund sponsors that from which the employee can choose their retirement benefits and rates be applied to. This has been designed to provide a portable and mobile plan for our professional faculty and staff. It serves currently about 2,500 active OUS participants. Our eligible employees are also have an option of choosing between the optional retirement program and the public employees retirement system when they first become eligible to participate in a retirement plan. And this is also vested on a five-year cliff vesting schedule. Plan assets under management by the four fund sponsors in participant-directed accounts today totals about $107 million, and that was effective at the end of 2003. House Bill 2104 amends the optional retirement plan statute, authorizing statute ORS 243.800, to incorporate PERS-related changes that became effective during the reforms of 2003. Under the optional retirement plan statute, employees that are eligible for membership in the public employees retirement system are permitted to irrevocably elect to participate in the optional retirement plan. With the addition of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plans in 2003, additional provisions are now required to establish participation rates and requirements for employees hired on or after August 29th of 2003, and for all new members now enrolled in individual account plan. After those changes were made in 2003, Mr. Chair, but I want to give you a little bit of history of how we got here to this bill, because it's quite relevant to the process and to where we are now and to the support that we have for the housekeeping amendments we're proposing. So after those changes were made in 2003, we formed a group of stakeholders, a coalition, if you will, to look at the relationship of the optional retirement program to PERS. And that group was made up of our faculty organizations, including the Associated Oregon Faculty, American Federation of Teachers, American Association of University Professors, that would be the PSU branch, section and specifically, the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate, some of our ORP fund sponsors were there to provide technical assistance to us, and the university system. During that interim, we explored a variety of different options to address that linkage. House Bill 2104 is a product of that effort. However, after we had the bill initially drafted, we saw some potential problems with some of the language. Specifically, we looked at Senate Bill 108, which is a PERS, a Public Employee Retirement System bill, and we wanted to make sure that our language didn't conflict with their language. Senate Bill 108 would define an inactive member as being an individual who has separated from all service of a public employer, and we did not want to have that specific definition for our optional retirement plan participants. So we had to seek some amendments, and those amendments are in the dash one that you have before you. So I'll walk through that if you would like me to. I'll do kind of a very high-level walkthrough because this is a very tough subject to get my head around, believe me. So the provisions of subsection 6A through 6F describe the PERS member's future status if that member elects to participate in the optional retirement program and clarifies procedural steps for transferring the account balances. The amendments maintain existing rights, privileges, and benefits for Public Employee Retirement System Chapter 238 members, that is the PERS pension portion, and extend similar privileges to the optional or to the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan Chapter 238A members. Section 1, sub 6 C and D outline membership status and the treatment of existing PERS accounts when non-vested and vested members of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan pension plan become new OUS employees and then elect to participate in the optional retirement program. These provisions parallel the provisions that have been in effect for public employee retirement service members who elect the optional retirement plan, as described in subsections 6A and 6B. I'll just stop and pause and make sure there's no questions there. I keep going
on.
Any
questions?
Okay. Go ahead. In subsection 6E, this subsection addresses the new defined contribution individual account plan. Those accounts were open for all PERS members in January of 2004. The transfer rules for those for these accounts are required for public employee retirement system members with pension benefits under both Chapter 238 and 238A. Subsection 6F is included to ensure that optional retirement plan participants do not access public employee retirement system benefits while currently employed by the Oregon University System and actively participating in the optional retirement program. So they can't take a withdrawal while still working for a public employer and under the optional retirement program. So as Janet mentioned, the lump sum, the offset for the lump sum payment, and we're addressing that issue in subsection 1, sub 9, where the additional phrase, before any offset under ORS 238.325, sub 9. This clarifies the intent of the original legislation that employer contributions for the optional retirement plan participants equal those that would have been made had the employee elected to become a public employee's retirement system member. When ORS 243.800 was proposed in 1995, lump sum payments to reduce unfunded actuarial liabilities, such as the one made by the state of Oregon in 2003, were not anticipated. The offset refers to the public employee retirement system rate reduction induced by that lump sum prepayment of pension obligations that are unrelated to the retirement benefits of the optional retirement program participants. Adding this provision clarifies the original intent of the legislature when the optional retirement plan was approved. And I should have given your assistant my testimony, and hopefully that will help. I'll just stand. Thank you, James. That concludes my prepared remarks, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions, Representative Chonkler?
Thank you. All them folks on your work group, they're all in support of this?
Yes.
Everyone.
Mr. Chair, Representative Chonkler, yes, we do have consensus of that work group, and some of them are actually here today.
All right. Thank you very much.
Any other questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, just, you know, this is a big subject to try to get my head around as well. I'm curious, does this whole system of taking monies out of the current PER system and putting it into this optional retirement plan, does that create any more, how do I put this, does that create any more stability problems for our PER system?
Unfunded liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, I don't believe that is the case. I'm looking at Denise for, yeah. I don't believe that there is would be any fiscal impact to the public employees retirement system. We have had the optional retirement program since 1995. As I said, we have about 2,500 members in that now, as opposed to however many members that might be in the public employees retirement system. So we have not heard that before from PERS. We've been working with the PERS staff. You'll forgive me for using that acronym, Mr. Chair. We have not heard that concern.
Thank you.
Representative Gilman.
Lisa, did this work group, because of all the changes we've made in PERS, did this work group consider the possibility that this optional program was not necessary anymore?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, no, because we strongly believe in this the optional retirement program. It's a proven program, and I'm going to defer to Denise to talk about some of the success of the program. And the fact that it's a mobile, transferable retirement plan for our faculty and administrators in the university system. We have a great deal of mobility among faculty, as you can imagine. They do leave the state and go work for another system or a private institution, in fact, and they can take this with them wherever they go because of the vendors that we offer them are national and maybe even international in some cases.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, Denise Younker, the administrator for the Optional Retirement Plan and Human Resources Director for Oregon University System. Regarding the use of the Optional Retirement Plan, we've seen that there is an annual about 10% turnover in participants because of the mobility of the people who elect the plan. And that shows us that it is serving the need that it was originally intended for, because we do have people moving in and out among national institutions primarily. And at that point, where they move from one university to another, which is the typical employment situation for the participants, then they have some portability to nationally recognized vendors. And they're not tied up waiting to be eligible for a distribution from a first pension when they may have left the state long prior. So we think that it's serving the needs that it was originally intended to serve.
As you explained, the intention of the program, or the optional retirement program, is to cover those people that are very mobile within the university population that probably don't stay within necessarily the Oregon University system and move on to other states or other places, and so this type of a plan is more mobile and works better for that type of population. Representative Schaffer.
Oh, I think Mr. Representative Gilman has hand up first.
Okay. No.
Well, go ahead. Okay.
Go ahead.
This is kind of unrelated, but due to our lack of money and ability to pay, you know, what the market rates might be for some of these really smart staff people, have you seen an increase in that percentage of mobility out of the state due to that, since you do track that for an unrelated reason?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, I'm afraid I don't have the details on that, but we can provide those. Our institutional research division can talk about the ingress and egress of faculty members, and we'll provide that to you.
And just so I can clarify, you know, we're trying to get money to get the really best and brightest teaching our kids, and we don't have it, so I'd imagine that percentage of mobility leaving may be going up because of that. That's out of curiosity I asked you that question. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions?
Well, one more.
Representative Gilman.
2,500 people enrolled or involved right now. Out of a number, how many?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilman, the enrollment in the optional retirement plan has, since it was implemented, been about 30% of the people who are eligible for retirement benefits in this class. So at this point, we have, for the academic and administrative employees who would be eligible for both PERS and for the optional retirement plan, 30% of those people elect the optional retirement plan.
So it's not even available for all university employees?
No, it is not.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there a physical impact?
Mr. Chair, no. There is no additional fiscal impact. These amendments merely continue an existing program.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Chair, Lisa, you had mentioned that some of the terminology that says the amounts go directly to the optional retirement plan. Maybe to get that on the record, that doesn't mean it's the same day.
Correct. We have, Mr. Chair, Administrator Adkins, we had talked to the Public Employees Retirement System staff, and they wanted to make sure that we understood that the language in the amendments, the dash one amendments, subsection E, it's on page 3. Line 3, it begins on line 2, excuse me. They wanted to make sure that we stated for the record that upon receiving the request, the Public Employees Retirement Board shall transfer the amounts directly to the optional retirement plan. Their concern is that that should not be interpreted as an immediate transfer, that they will maybe initiate the transfer process upon that request. And we believe that the Public Employees Retirement System and Board could handle that make that clear and specific in their rulemaking.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Holder.
Just one more. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just so I've got this straight, a public employee can't access this plan until they've moved out of a PERS employer or working for a PERS employer? In other words, they can't access this plan while they're working for the university, for example, of Oregon?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, a university employee, administrative or faculty employee, can elect to participate in an optional retirement program at any time. It's a one-time, irrevocable election.
Even while they're not mobile?
Yes, even when they're not mobile.
Okay, thank you.
And so...
Mr. Chair,
go ahead.
I'm sorry, you might...
Mr. Chair, Representative Holivier, maybe perhaps more to your question, I can clarify that a participant who's participating in the optional retirement plan does not have access to PERS benefits, so that the person wouldn't be simultaneously receiving a PERS pension and making contributions to the optional retirement plan. That's what the provisions are intended to prevent. That would be an in-service distribution, which is clearly not permissible for tax-qualified plans.
And so it's either or. They can belong to the PERS system or this optional plan, and they have that option one time?
That's correct. That's
correct. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
If I could, I just would like to just clarify because of the lump sum payment issue. The intent of the language is to prevent the occurrence that we experienced last fall. The intent of the language that we're proposing is to prevent that from happening in the future. And I just ask you to adopt the amendments and move the bill today. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Linden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, Bill Linden, representing the Association of Oregon Faculties. The previous witnesses gave a very good explanation of what this bill is intended to do. We want to express our support for it. Our group was originally involved in the 95 legislation that set the optional retirement plan in place. We felt it was very necessary to do because it's one more way in which Oregon can compete with other state university systems for the best and the brightest faculty. So it is very important for faculty to have the option. As you've heard, a significant number have decided to join this plan because faculty, more so than other classes of state employees, frankly, are more mobile, and the portability of the ORP is very, very important and very important to maintain. So the housekeeping and other technical changes that were described to you are necessary to sort of realign that plan with the reality of state employee retirement post-2003. I will note for the record, and they referred to it as well, we had a temporary disagreement with them about the rate basis that occurred after Measure 29 passed in September 2003, and that resulted in a reduction in the overall state PERS rate. But the language in this bill makes it clear that the basis for the optional retirement plan contribution is not to be affected by any buy-down of liabilities within the PERS system, which is, again, a totally different system. So I would recommend your favorable consideration of this bill with the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions? Representative Holley.
Having a tough time with one aspect of this. Why wouldn't this plan be available to all PERS employees and just be restricted to administrative and academic employees? I recognize the fact that they are able to move and more likely to move out of state, but you know, a janitor could move to California too, and so I'm, you know, just a hypothetical, I guess. I just kind of wonder why it's restrictive.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, I can give you a partial answer. I know in terms of our client faculty, their mobility is well documented, so it's important for them. I am not, frankly, certain if the other groups of PERS employers and member groups have ever sat down and looked at this as a as something that ought to be available statewide. You know, it's certainly something this committee could invite them to do, but I don't think it's happened, to be honest with you.
Okay. I was just curious.
Lisa?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Polby, actually, in 1995, when we introduced and had the optional retirement program implemented, the classified employees at that time asked not to be included.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that explains it. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chairman, Representative Polby shows you that my memory is fading.
I can relate to that.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shaw.
You know, we aren't really post-2003 yet. I wish we were in some ways. But will the court's decisions have any impact on this one way or the other?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Schaffler, only if the court decision results in some sort of retroactive employer contribution change. Mm-hmm. I think that's the only possibility. But I defer to Ms. Vala.
It would just be the quantity of the contribution then probably would be the difference.
I believe so, because again, this is a totally separate system from PERS, mm-hmm. but it is tied to PERS in the limited sense that the contribution rate is the PERS rate. So if the court were to say we're invalidating these pieces of 2003 legislation, and as a result that employer rate will go up retroactively to X, that would have to be applied back, in our opinion, to the ORP members as well.
Thank you.
And for the record, I see Denise at the back of the room nodding affirmative. Any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I think we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2104 and open a work session on House Bill 2104. And entertain a motion to adopt the -1 amendments. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the -1 amendments. I'd move the committee vote aye and move the -1 amendments into House Bill 2104.
Representative Kitts moves the -1s to House Bill 2104. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Holvey.
I must admit that I do have some reservations that this plan is restrictive to administrative and academic employees only, and withstanding that the classified folks didn't opt to participate in this, still raises a question in my mind. What if there was a classified employee that wanted to participate in this? Would he have any some sort of legal recourse as far as being discriminated against and not being able to participate in this plan? It just, you know, I don't know that question's been asked, and I do have some reservations about that. Thank you.
Mary? Please.
Save them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I really was just going to sit in the back of the room and keep quiet today. When this retirement plan was initially put together, our local at OHSU that represents about 4,500 classified employees actually hired another actuary to do a side-by-side analysis of this system as compared to PERS so that we could make an educated recommendation to our members and to new hires about which system they should go into. After that analysis, we really did determine that the plan that Mr. Linden is referring to, this new system, really is, it's a very good benefit for folks who are not going to do a career service in one employer because of their professional credentials. And that it was a nice benefit for us to be able to offer to attract temporary or limited time talent to come into Oregon to do special projects or to, I mean, even to teach, because we bring in a lot of very specialized instructors at OHSU for limited periods of time, and this gives them something that's more portable and more easily accessed. This is just a good system for them. We regularly encourage our members to stay in PERS because PERS is designed for career employees who are not going to leave. And so we think these are good side-by-side plans. We do not have a problem with the changes you made in it today or in the proposals that Mr. Linden is suggesting.
Thank you, Mary. Any questions on it?
Mr. Chair, I'm happy that you're happy with it, but it still doesn't really address my question. If there was a classified employee that wanted to participate in this program, I'm worried that this, you know, has some legal problems with it as far as discriminating against that employee. I will vote for it, but I just wanted to express those concerns on this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holley, I appreciate your concerns. From our analysis, for a long-term 30-year employee, we can't imagine why they would want to be anywhere but in PERS, even with all of the changes.
All the warts?
What?
All the warts?
Well, the warts seem to be scar tissue now, or getting there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Just cut that down.
We have a motion to adopt the dash ones. Is there any other concerns? If not, we'll adopt the dash ones and Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2104-1 move to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
As amended. Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2104 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
I thought you wanted me to point to you.
Representative
Stock. Aye.
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Representative
Escobar.
Aye.
Chair Brown. Aye. Motion carries. Representative
Kitts. Mr. Chair, I would ask the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Shields to vote on 2064.
Representative Kitts asks that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Shields to vote on which one?
2064.
We are suspended. Representative Shields, how do you vote?
Thank you. Representative Kitts, aye.
Representative Kitts, Representative
I vote aye again.
votes aye. And, okay, we need a carrier for the 2104. Everybody's looking out the window.
Huh? I'll carry this thing.
Okay, Representative Gilman will carry the bill on the floor. He thoroughly understands it. Is there actually be... yes, most questions.
I had questions with this bill.
We want to open a work session for the introduction of some committee bills. A committee bill? A. We have LC 2489. Can you give us a...
Mr. Chair, the House Senate LC 2489 would increase the maximum permissible license fees for certain types of food processing businesses based on annual gross sales. Mr. Chair, Sean Miller's here that requested this introduction, and but it's a coalition of groups that worked with the Department of Agriculture. It's my understanding.
Any questions? The chair would entertain a motion to introduce LC 2489 as a committee bill. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I would move the committee adopt LC 2489 as a committee bill.
Representative Kitts moves we adopt LC 2489 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's adopted. Is there anything else, Janet?
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to hear from members how the routing of materials is best done to your offices. Yesterday we did an email because everything was able to be emailed. Sometimes things aren't. I just wondered about getting things ahead of time, how things are working for you and your offices. Or if you still do want things ahead of time and things like that.
We're so disorganized in my office, Jen. No, I shouldn't say that.
Our office put the new meeting on F group. But the only thing I would request is that we get the any changes or anything that we're doing there a little earlier, because when you walk in at 8 o'clock in the morning, sometimes you don't get to the bottom of that file because it's pretty good size, and sometimes we miss some stuff that way because we start this thing at 8:30, and therefore we don't have time to react to it when it's done late in the afternoon or after we leave.
Right. And that's our difficulty of getting them, because we're still scrambling to get things out, and especially on Fridays, because there's no day between Friday and Monday. But the paper copies are easier than your staff printing them out.
Yeah, I'm still struggling with my email system. Go ahead.
Janet, either is fine with me. Either my staff can pull them on the paper copies, and I'm whatever's amenable to making the committee run as smooth as possible.
Okay, and we'll just get them there as soon as we can.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay, anything else? Seeing none, we are adjourned.
Thanks for the courtesy.